The question that we will first discuss is, what kind of God is Yahweh, the covenant God of Israel? Now, these words, these four letters on the blackboard, YHWH, are the four consonants written in Hebrew for the name of God. And no one knows exactly anymore how to pronounce that particular name of God. And the opinions were, originally it was Jehovah. Now that is totally discarded by every scholar among Jews and Christians. And it is said that Jehovah was a combination with Adonai. And that's why it was a mistake. So it is a mispronunciation, really, Jehovah. That's too bad for the Jehovah's Witnesses, by the way. And the more academic approach is to say that it is approximately Yahweh. Or Yahweh. See, we still don't know exactly. There's two Dutch scholars who have written adamantly that it should be Yahoo. So you can see that we don't know exactly the pronunciation. But I accept, from my academic background, that Yahweh is the commonly accepted pronunciation of the tetragrammaton, the four letters of God. The high priest was the only one who pronounced the name only once a year on the Day of Atonement, and he never wrote it down. So we don't know. And that shows you there's no magic in knowing exactly how to pronounce the name, because the name is not just a word or letters, but stands for a character, as all the names are, of course, in the Bible. And what kind of God is Yahweh that makes him unique? First of all, he is the creator of heaven and earth. Creator, that is, of course, Genesis 1, verse 1. No one else has created heaven and earth, so that makes him unique. Secondly, and no less important, is that he is the redeemer of his covenant people. And that, of course, is called Israel. Israel, also a name that is of great importance to know, as wrestlers with God in Genesis 32. Now, or is it Genesis 28? Genesis 32, I think. So, we have here an idea about Yahweh that is also unique. Who redeemed Israel from Egypt? Poured out these 10 plagues. Brought the water down on the Egyptian army that were persecuting the Israelites. We do not speak about Jews in those days, because Jews is a name that comes from Judea, Judeans, and they're from Judah, and therefore one of the sons of Jacob. So it's only used since the book of Esther, since the Babylonian captivity. So you cannot say Moses brought the Jews out of Egypt. That is an anachronism, because the Jews is mostly concentrating on the tribes of Judah. But here we speak about Israelites, or as the Hebrews say, the Bnei Yisrael, the sons of Israel. And God said to Moses in Exodus 3 and in Exodus 6, tell Pharaoh, I am has sent you. I am that I am. And again, that is derived from the verb that makes up Yahweh. And the content of I am is not I am self-existent. That's a philosophical approach. It is not, of course, absent from I am that he is self-existent. But that is still a neutral concept. So what? You know, you can ask, self-existent. So in the Bible, there is not a philosophical approach at all. It is an existential approach. It approached the total existence in connection with people. And so, I am that I am in Exodus 3 and 6 as a new name was the old name with a new meaning. The old meaning was, since the book of Genesis, I am the God who makes promises. Genesis 15, 13, all full of promises. I will give you this land. I will, after 400 years, bring your people out of Egypt. Promises, promises, promises. But since Moses, a new epoch began, the God of promises begins to become the God of the fulfillment of his promises. And that is the new name of Yahweh that Moses had never heard before. That this God is not only a God of words, but a God of action. A God who can also fulfill his promises. And that becomes then Yahweh and stands for the is equal to the covenant God. He is a God of the covenant. And that word covenant is a central term in all Old Testament theology. Because that is the uniqueness of a God. He has obliged himself, condescended himself, out of his pure freedom to make a covenant relationship with human, sinful human beings, the people of Israel. A covenant, like a marriage is a covenant, isn't it? And it's a two-way street, as you well know. And it only works when it is a two-way street, properly. So this covenant is a unique characteristic of Yahweh, the God of Israel. So Yahweh comes almost to stand equal with the Creator, covenant God, the Creator Redeemer, who led Israel out of Egypt. That is behind Yahweh. It is not just a philosophical abstract idea anymore. And you will read about this a little more in the textbook, and now you can have a sermon on that. Because our people don't know about that much. Remember, they know about doctrines. And so we need to bring some new life in the old doctrines. And sometimes new wine in old skins is not good for the skins. But that doesn't... But we are not worried about that because people are hungry and thirsty for life. For real participation. They're sick and tired of hearing the abstract ideas that you must believe or you are not accepted by God. We need to, wherever we go, each in our own sphere, we need to be a light and a blessing for other people. And we can do that only when we drink ourselves straight from the waters of living life. So, that is the first idea that we want to know who is the God of ancient Israel. Now, on what basis does he enter into a covenant relationship with Israel is a very important question. And what is the covenant? What does it imply? How do his justice and mercy relate to each other? That's a very central question. Many have never understood yet how mercy and justice can be harmonized, because they are easily put in contrast with each other. Isn't it? Some people ask for mercy instead of justice even. And you can see that they have an abstract idea about justice. Because in the Bible, in the Old Testament, God never has abstract justice. It is always merciful. And we will see that gradually more and more. We have to let the shaft sink deep in the mine. And some things only gradually can be caught. Now I would like to open the Bible with you, and don't come here ever without a Bible, because, yes, and it doesn't matter what translation, even the old King James is allowed here, but I prefer Bibles with new in it, like New International, or New King James, or any other new standard Bible, you may choose. In fact, I would suggest that you never get just obsessed with one translation. It limits. Every translation is a loss of the original. You will see that more. And therefore, we need If we cannot handle much of the original languages, we need to have at least three translations on hand, so we can get perspectives. There's no translation perfect, but God can use imperfect translations a lot. I'm going to the book of Deuteronomy 32. Deuteronomy 32. And you will be surprised to read that it is a song of Moses. Of course, when I ask where's the song of Moses, everyone says Exodus 15. After the drowning of the Egyptian army, they were singing the song of Moses. And that's the song of Moses we will see in Revelation 15. For the 144,000 especially. So we see the song of Moses has typological connections, type and anti-type. So the song of Moses is important. And now we are surprised to hear another song of Moses. Well, if the same Moses is singing, it can't be too much different. And we see here that he concentrates on God in verse 4 as follows. He is the rock. His works are perfect, and all his ways are just. A faithful God, who does no wrong, upright and just is he, is worthy to be memorized. Now this is praising God. See? And maybe some of our prayers could learn from more becoming more God-centered than man-centered. If you have a prayer that the angels and God want to listen to, it should be a prayer that talks about God a little more. I hardly hear such prayers. There's always, Lord, give me this, give me that, Lord. Help me here, help me there. And we are needy people, you know. And Jesus says also, give us our daily bread. But you have noticed he doesn't begin with that. The Lord's Prayer doesn't begin with, give me my daily bread. It begins and ends with God. That is a revival of prayer that we can learn, especially from the book of Psalms. I have a lot more to say in the book of Psalms later. Now, Deuteronomy 32 verse 4 says, he is the rock. And you have to understand what rock is in Palestine, you know. It's a limestone rock. It's full of holes and caves. That means it is a hiding place. Not bad after all, then. See, it's not a rock like they build on Gibraltar or New York homes on. This is a rock where you hide in. That is God. Rock of ages cleft for me. Let me hide myself in thee. Where's the choir that sings that? Now, here's the rock. His works are perfect. Now listen carefully to my question. And don't rush into quick answers. Does Moses say that God is perfect here? See, everyone now wants to be careful. What does it say is perfect? His works. Now, Moses is not a philosopher who says God is perfect there up behind Orion in the stars. Because people would immediately say, so what? I'm not perfect and I have a problem. So what's the use of God there being perfect? See, that is an abstraction that the Bible never enters into, how God is in himself. And the first lesson again for this hour is, all we hear about God is about God's relations to his covenant people and to the human race. Isn't that wonderful? And that is really beneficial for us. And God says all his works, and it's of course works in creation and works in redemption. How did he save Israel from the approaching Egyptian army with all these chariots? It says in Exodus 15, God is a man of war, Ish, Milchama, he is a man of war. His name is Yahweh, it says in Exodus 15 verse 3. And then he says, this God is a God who destroyed the enemy in order to redeem his people. See, the redemption is an act of holy war. Exodus 15. That's where eschatology and soteriology here connect, you see? Because if you want to know what Armageddon is, you have to go back to Exodus 15, where it says Yahweh is a man of war. See? But God is not a warrior in order to shed blood and to revenge or to rejoice in the killing. Even the Talmud from the Jewish people says, when the Egyptian army drowned in the turbulent waters of the Red Sea, God wept. God is not delighting in this. He is not delighted in the death of the sinner at all, says Ezekiel. So when God is defeating and destroying an enemy, it is only for the other higher purpose to redeem his people, or they would be destroyed. And God has to be faithful to his covenant. So it is an act of faithfulness. What a God this is going to be. This is a God of words and action. This is a God whose actions form patterns in history that promise how he will act again in the future. So the whole concept of typology is rooted in the very character and essence of God. Because he is the same yesterday, today and tomorrow. And that is that he is a redeemer God. That is the purpose. All the Psalms end with redemption. All the books of the Bible end with redemption. God is not a God who is delighting in just putting anyone down or getting him into the eternal fire of hell, so to speak, but is interested in everyone's salvation. And Moses says his works are perfect. And what is that meaning, perfect? Now there is a word here that we need to write on the blackboard again for perfect. Because you get a little extra Hebrew here in this class. And every one of you who wants to know his Bible better needs to go to Hebrew class. Because all translations lose some from the original meaning. That's widely recognized. Tamim is the word for perfect. And you find it in the textbook more explained, with more texts. Tamim does not mean that God is perfect in himself, although that is assumed. But it doesn't focus on this. That God is perfect means he establishes a perfect relationship of redemption with his chosen people. His works. And these, of course, are here particularly the redemption of Israel from Egypt. Did you know how many of these soldiers and charioteers and of these horses survived? Not one. Now that's a perfect destruction. And Israel, they didn't lose anyone. Even little lambs, no claws stayed behind. They all were saved. It's a perfect salvation. See? And that is what is meant by perfection. In this text here, all his ways are just. They are in harmony with the covenant will of God. A faithful God. See, that word faithfulness stresses the meaning of perfection. God is perfect in his faithfulness. By acting. When are you faithful to your promises? When you fulfill your promises. Then you are perfect. When you fulfill your promises. Isn't that interesting? You can preach about this. In fact, there's so much preaching, I can't be old enough to preach it all. So I will preach in the Spanish church this Sabbath. About the meaning of the fourth gospel. You're welcome. Deuteronomy 32 verse 4 has several lines. Have you noticed that? It's not just one line, it's several lines. Now, what is this style? This style is typical for all poetry. This is not prose. This is poetry. And the book of Psalms, especially, is the poetry par excellence. And what is the style of poetry in the Bible? It's not like we have rhyming words at the end. And then we feel a poet when we rhyme the end of words. We are poets. Now, in the Hebrew, there is no rhyming of words at all in poetry. The whole rhythm is poetry. And the repetition of the meaning of lines, it's called the parallelism of the member lines. Parallelismus membrorum. And that, the poetic device of two or three times repeating in different ways the same essence, brings out the meaning more fully. You see, if you say things twice differently, people have a better chance to understand you. Use synonyms for words and subject, and that's what the Hebrew poets were masters in. And this has even more importance than beauty. This is of hermeneutical importance. That means one line is explained more fully in the other line. And together we get the fuller meaning of it. Like, it's like hearing music from two loudspeakers. See, God speaks stereophonically to us. He speaks in two or three lines. I mean, it is very important. We see it three times. How does Psalm 1 begin? Three times explaining how the wicked is not. And in Psalm 32, three times, how blessed is the man whose sins are forgiven. Three times. That means brings home the seriousness, and that God doesn't want anyone, you know, to limit things, to restrict it. So we have here the word faithfulness. A faithful God is also further explaining the term of perfection. Now, I need to go to another word, another text that deals with perfection, and that staying still with God, I will go to three places now that I will like to deal with. Three. I will write them on the blackboard, and then we'll talk about each one of these three. So here they are. First, we're dealing with text that deal with God's righteousness now. So these three, that's the combining factor. It is the tzedakah of Yahweh. Tzedakah, that is the righteousness from tzedek, righteous. And we have three texts that I would like to read with you. First Samuel 12:7, and then Judges 5, verses 10 through 11, and then we'll read Micah 6, verses 3 to 5. Now this will conclude our class for today. And we will now read them all three and then explain them and make a conclusion. Okay, let's open that text in 1 Samuel 12. Some of you may say, how do I get all these texts together? That would be a good question. So I ask the question on behalf of you. How do we get these texts together? And I will answer this by saying, as part of my doctoral study, I had to use Hebrew to get to the bottom of it. And I used the Hebrew Concordance from Lisowski. Some of you may say, how do I get all these texts together? That would be a good question. So I ask the question on behalf of you. How do we get these texts together? And I will answer this by saying, as part of my doctoral study, I had to use Hebrew to get to the bottom of it. And I used the Hebrew Concordance from Lisowski. And that we have that here, of course. And in the Hebrew, I saw that the word tzedakah and its plural, tzidkot, tzitkot, the righteousnesses, that these terms with regard to God were given, among others, in these places with surprising explanations. And that's why I put these three together. And this is a kind of sermon. And I will give you then 1 Samuel 12. And who is speaking, of course, in Samuel? You said it. Samuel himself is speaking. And let's read in verse 7. Now then, stand here, because I'm going to confront you with evidence before the Lord. And when you see Lord in four capitals, that what is the original in Hebrew? Yahweh. See? If it is only one capital, L, and then small O-R-D, then it is Adonai or Master. But here it is evidently the covenant God who's speaking, on behalf of whom Samuel's speaking. And he says, before the Lord, as to all the tzitkot, the righteous acts performed by the Lord for you and your fathers. So this Yahweh is performing righteousnesses. And the Hebrew doesn't even have the word acts in it. That's why acts should be in italics, but it isn't done there in the New International Version. Do you have any version where it is in italics? What is it in that Bible, Sheila? What kind of Bible is that? That is also the New International. Oh, you bring here tomorrow. Pardon me? Saving deeds. Even the word righteousness has fallen out. I resent that. What kind of freedom is that? That's interpretation. Happens to be a beautiful interpretation, but it is for the man who doesn't know Hebrew, has no relation to righteousness anymore. That's why I deplore that, and every preacher should have a basic knowledge of Greek, of Hebrew at least. Greek I don't care for. That's a waste of time. You know, because the basic language and meaning and theology comes from Hebrew Bible. The Greek New Testament doesn't bring Greek philosophy. It is Greek words with Hebrew meanings. That's the title of that book by Hill. Greek meanings, Greek words, and Hebrew meanings. So Hebrew is the essential. I don't understand why our church was not a little smarter and begin to make Hebrew required in the college. Instead of Greek, you know. It is now? In some place maybe, huh? Oh, here, yeah. But in the colleges, yeah. Yeah. Well, we're getting all the time better. Yes, sir. Ah, righteous act. That is better. Is the word acts in italics? No. See, now you don't even know exactly what the Hebrew says, and I will then give you the secret. It says only tzitkot Yahweh. The righteousnesses of Yahweh. And you understand that must be explained. What is the righteousnesses? Now, in the Septuagint, what is the Septuagint? That is the Greek translation of the Old Testament used by the apostles and Jesus. See, and the book of Hebrews only quotes from the Septuagint. So that's almost considered an inspired translation. Now, that translates the plural with the singular dikaiosune, righteousness, as a characteristic of God. So we should not make too much of singular and plural here. But what I'm trying to get at is, what is now the righteousness or righteousnesses of Yahweh? And that's where the Bible student gets to know something that the superficial Christian never knows. And maybe the translation will even give the interpretation here that is correct. It is not a righteousness in heaven, but it is a righteousness in action. And therefore the translation is, he says, Samuel says, I will show you the righteous acts or deeds of Yahweh that he has done before you and for on behalf of you. And what kind of righteous acts did God do? And you always come back to the Exodus salvation or you have lost touch. That is the fundamental credo for the Hebrew Old Testament. And that is, he is the God of redemption since the redemption from Egypt. And the Passover commemorates that. So that is the fundamental stand. That is the birthday of the nation. That is the beginning of their existence. Otherwise there would be no Israelite nation anymore, because all the baby boys were doomed to be thrown into the Nile. What happens with a nation when there are only girls left? See? It's absolved. So this nation was under a death decree by the Pharaoh. And God, through Moses, interfered and redeemed them from death. And therefore is the Exodus salvation is the birthday, is the beginning, is the proof that their God is not the God of promises only, but a God who can people from death to life. That God is Yahweh. That word Yahweh has a ring to it that brings a Jewish heart even today to excitement. You know, that credo is written up in Deuteronomy 6, verse 4. Yahweh Eloheinu, our God, is Echad, is one. See? There is no other God than this God, because he is the only God who redeemed Israel from Egypt. And that's why he is the only one they should worship. And that's why God is so stringent in Deuteronomy 13. If you worship another God, you have no more right to live. Capital punishment for the idolater. And it's understandable. It's high treason. So, when we talk about, in the Old Testament, about the tzedakah and the tzedkot Yahweh, the Israelite is not thinking about a God who is sinless. No, they're thinking about a God who reached down with a perfect redemption for his people and a perfect destruction for the impenitent and persecuting enemies. That is perfection in action. So perfection is a synonym for righteousness. The righteousness. And let's read the text again so you will get the swing of it before we go to the next text. And I'm reading again. 1 Samuel 12, verse 7, where Samuel speaks to the people. Now then, stand here, because I'm going to confront you with evidence before the Lord as to all the righteous acts performed by the Lord for you and your fathers. And what is he then explaining? Read on, verse 8. You will see what he's going to talk about. What are the righteous acts? After Jacob entered Egypt, they cried to the Lord for help, and the Lord sent Moses and Aaron, who brought your forefathers out of Egypt, and settled them in this place. The Exodus redemption is the first and central core of God's righteousness. Do you get it? When you talk about God's righteousness, you're not talking about God in the abstract anymore. In the Bible, when you talk about God's perfection and God's righteousness, you're talking about his saving acts. That's one of the translations, saving acts. But we need to keep it as an interpretation of righteousness. That's lost in that translation that has no more righteous. I think the translation should not become so much interpretation we lose the original terms. Let the pastor have the responsibility to explain righteous acts into saving deeds. That is his commission. But they do it here for you in some translations. Now you can read on that he is going on to explain more of God's righteous acts, because God has always brought salvation even when people were in sinful rebellion. And they cried unto the Lord. You read on, read this whole chapter, and you will see that it is a glorification of God's righteousness. Okay, now we're going to Judges 5, Judges 5. And this is one of the magnificent examples. And again, you will see a connection. Like we saw a connection just a moment ago between Exodus 14 and then going into 15. Here's the redemption in Exodus 14. And here is the Song of Moses. Song of Moses. That I was, as in English. And this Song of Moses is, of course, the type of the song we will sing in all eternity. That's why in Revelation 15, in the last Bible book, you will have, they will all sing the Song of Moses, and then it adds, and of the Lamb. So you see that the song is based on a new redemption. And now we see in Judges 4, again, a relationship with the next chapter, and that is a great redemption of one of the great holy wars in Old Testament, in which God delivered his people miraculously, and then Deborah, or Deborah, as you say here, Deborah, she is singing about this salvation. The Song of Deborah. Can you see that redemption and praise, redemption and singing, thank you, that redemption and singing, you know, are interconnected? We shouldn't sing about nothing or about abstract things. We should be singing about from a new experience. And let's read now in Judges chapter 5, verse 10 and 11, these words. And this is Deborah and Barak. They sang this song. He was an army general, wasn't it, of the Israel volunteer army. And then in Judges 5 verse 10, she says, "You who ride on white donkeys, sitting on your saddle blankets, and you who walk along the road, consider the voice of the singers at the watering places. They recite the Tzidkot Yahweh." There it is again. From now on, I want you to repeat that still it is in deep in your soul. We need to preach the Tzidkot. Can you say Tzidkot? Tzidkot. Yeah, you come home, you tell your wife, you learn about Tzidkot. She has more respect for you. Tzidkot Yahweh. And you give her a Bible study so that she keeps up with you. Why is you singing on the roof for the hallelujah? She sits down in the basement and says, "What's happening?" You need to bring her along, or him along. So this is Deborah. She says, "Remember to sing about the Tzidkot Yahweh." And then she says, "The righteous acts of the Lord, the righteous acts of his warriors." Then the people of the Lord went down to the city gates. So these verses again speak about that same mysterious term, the righteousness of God in the plural, and these are righteous acts. And what happened? What are the righteous acts he's singing about? Go back to chapter 4 and you will see that it is a marvelous victory of a handful of people who had no weapons against 600 iron chariots. We call them tanks today. And they came down the mountain to overrun that nomad people who have only bow and arrow. And there was no ghost of a chance the Israelites could win. But when Deborah says, "The Lord will deliver them in your hand," they thought by themselves, "How in the world is God going to do that?" And then God did something that he always does. He has secret weapons. He brought down from heaven a downpour of rain so heavy that it waterlogged all the chariots. The iron chariots couldn't move anymore. And the Israelites could just knock them off one after another with a bow and arrow till no one was left. Judges 4, it was near the waters of Megiddo. Megiddo? Armageddon. Yep, a type here. A type, a wonderful type. And so we see in Judges 4 and 5 a very important act of God's Tzidkot, his righteousness. It was again to defeat a hostile enemy who was intent on the death of his people. And God at the last moment says, they will find their own death. And Israelites didn't even need to do too much, because they were given, delivered in their hands by a marvelous way. That not a man was left, says Exodus, Judges 4. Not a man was left. And I leave you to read at home Judges 4 and 5 completely. And you will find it back in your textbook. Judges 4 and 5. See, two chapters together all the time. First the act, and then the reaction of Israel. God is interested in God's, in human reaction to his acts and deeds. And what is the reaction in Exodus 15 and in Judges 5? Praise. They're not standing there indifferently say, whew, wow, I almost didn't make it. No, they say, God, you are something. And God says, sing? No, you are somebody. See? God is a powerful redeemer. You can rely on, you can trust on, although he comes on his own time only. And now one more text for the last 5 minutes. And that is Micah 6. Can you turn quickly to Micah? He is beyond the large books until you reach Micah 6. And there we read in verse 3 to 5. My people. Who was Micah? He was a prophet of God. Sent to where? To the remaining tribes of Judah and Benjamin and Levi in Jerusalem. So Micah is preaching like Isaiah in Jerusalem to a people who were lukewarm, formalistic. And what do we read here? My people. No, I have to start in verse 3. That's also my people. See how God still considers an apostate people? My people, he says. What have I done to you? How have I burdened you? Answer me. And God is interested. I brought you up out of Egypt. See what's God reminding us always of? Of his first redemption. That is the basis for revival. Not the law, but redemption. I brought you up out of Egypt and redeemed you from the land of slavery. God says, for don't forget you ever this. I sent Moses to lead you, also Aaron and Miriam. My people, remember what Balak, king of Moab, counseled? What did Balak counsel? He says, curse this people. Remember that? Balaam? Curse this people, he said to Balaam. And what Balaam, son of Beor, answered? What did he answer? Blessings on Israel. Wasn't that a reversal? Now here you see God can overrule even your words. You want to curse and God says comes out a blessing. He says, God says, remember that I did this for you. Don't forget what I did. Remember. That's the third time in verse 5. Remember your journey from Shittim to Gilgal. Shittim on the one side of the Jordan River. Gilgal on the other side of the Jordan. What happened with the Jordan River? He dried it up in order to let his people go into the promised land. A God of action. These are God's righteousness, that you may remember, that you may know that Tzidkot Yahweh, verse 5, ends again with that mysterious term that is no longer mysterious for you after these words. And that is that the righteous acts of God, the righteousness of God, is a redeeming righteousness. And not a condemning righteousness. But was it not condemning for the enemy? Yes. So the righteousness of God has two manifestations. A judgment side and a saving side aspect. There is a twofold manifestation of God's righteousness. A twofold manifestation. It is either to punish, it is a punishing righteousness, or it is a saving righteousness. It all depends on which side you are. Within the covenant people, or against the covenant people. Whether you receive this or that manifestation of God's righteousness. That is the beauty of understanding the Bible from its own context. And letting the Bible terms be defined by its own context. So context is the key word to understand a term. So we do not say perfection. Let's open Webster's dictionary. What is perfection? That's what the baby talkers do. You know, they don't know. So they say, well, let's go to the dictionary. Let's go to the encyclopedia. Let's call the president. No, you don't do that. Or you read Ellen White. No, you don't do that. If you are having the Bible and the Bible alone as your norm and standard, your supreme norm, then the Bible can stand on its own feet. It can define its own terms. And it takes a little more work, but once you have got it, you've got a method now. You do not take a text in isolation anymore. You have to read whole chapters, and you have to see the parallel lines, and you have to see how the terms in different ways come out the same way. The righteousness of God is only condemning and punitive for the enemies, but it is saving and redeeming for God's people. And that is good news for people in the covenant, people today who wonder how they can ever stand and appeal like David, save me in your righteousness.
You have been listening to another special American Christian Ministries presentation. This recording has been digitally reprocessed from the original audio cassette or reel-to-reel in order to make this CD available. The audio quality was improved as much as possible. International copyright, American Christian Ministries. All rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.AmericanChristianMinistries.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. American Christian Ministries is not a one-man band. It is an orchestra of outstanding speakers who are all on the same theological page. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with our speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.